Hey, it's Jackie. I'm working on new episodes, but wanted to share another bonus one with you. This is my second pilot episode, so the second attempt at podcasting ever. This was published on my website in May of 2016, and it includes stories about how to help from Hans Johnson and Tanya Layden, two amazing people that have really interesting stories. They're both out of Africa, both very different perspectives, and there's a lot of really cool music. You'll hear why. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. In January of 2010, a massive earthquake struck Haiti. Over 100,000 people died. Millions were impacted. We saw the images on TV, we learned about it through social media. There were people in need, and people wanted to help. Some sent money, and others felt like that just wasn't enough. So some people organized food drives and clothing drives and packaged up medicine to send over to Haiti. And they felt like if they could reach somebody that needed it, doing something was better than nothing. I read an interesting article recently. It was a blog post by Claire Durham. She's from the International Red Cross Federation. She's somebody that worked in the midst of the disaster. And one of the things that she said about the donations is that they do more harm than good. In a disaster-stricken area, there's already chaos. And these unwanted goods clog ports. They take up space that's already scarce. And they take away time from aid workers. They prevent people from getting the help that they need. And the issues don't stop there. Donations also impact the local economy. Claire said that local shop owners who may have lost their family members and their home then find their businesses crumbling as food and clothing is imported. Helping can be hard because our intentions are so good, but without really understanding what's going on, we might not be helping at all. And that's what today's show is about, knowing how to help. You're listening to Changemaker, stories from people making a difference. I'm Jackie Biederman. You know how as a kid you see a place on TV or in movies and you dream about going there? For Hans Johnson, this place was Africa. And one day his dad went to Kenya, and that place that seemed so far away was now real.
My dad went, and he brought back souvenirs and stories and pictures, and most importantly, he brought back sound recordings from just like a little tape recorder. My parents are musicians, and we grew up in a musical family, so that's what I really took, I think, the most was the music. And I said, wow, they've got some cool music there. This was just like 12 years old or something. I was a little kid.
This was the first time that Hans heard music from the Maasai. The Maasai are a tribe of people in Africa, and they're one of the most well-known because they live around the game reservations that tourists go to. There are over 800,000 Maasai people living in Kenya. So it was years later, shortly after Hans finished high school, that he rediscovered these old tapes. And he wanted to hear more.
I called up the Smithsonian, I went to the local libraries and tried to find all these different ethnic recordings. And this was in the time before the internet was a good resource for anything, really. And Smithsonian, Library of Congress, they all said, you know, there are no recordings of Maasai music out there.
Hans saw that as a problem. He wanted people to experience the beauty of Maasai music. So he decided to record it himself. His dad had a friend in Kenya that agreed to show him around, so he cobbled together enough money to buy a plane ticket and some recording equipment.
I'm kind of naive, assuming that I should be the one to do it, and B, that you know this music is something that they would want out there. I was kind of assuming that everything would just roll smoothly and I could just go do it. So,
so what happened? So you went there?
Yeah, I went there, and there were this. Small Maasai community down in the Rift Valley, about an hour or two from Nairobi. Amazing, surreal experience at the time. It was kind of like, okay, finally, I've made it.
I made it
this far. So yeah, they introduced me to everybody, and then the church choir started singing, and dancing, and it really hooked me. I sold a CD of those recordings. I think I printed like 50. I sold them, and the money from that I used to pay the school fees of the person who had hosted me. He was an adult male who had to drop out of school in, I think, about eighth grade. So that was my first experience giving back somehow to the community. So
he was invited back to record more music. So he works some odd jobs to earn money, and his friends also pitched in to help him fund his next trip.
So what I did is I arranged for some guys to get together and record traditional music. And then I learned that there were also traditional songs that women sang. And we got a group of women together, and they sang songs as well, beautiful songs. On top of that, I always had my recorder with me, so I recorded kids playing in the yard and women milking the cows when they sing and stuff like that. When I got back, I had a lot of songs, I mean hundreds of songs. And I knew that I was probably sitting on the largest collection of Maasai recordings, at least that I was aware of. So I wanted to be very careful about the songs I picked and how I arranged it and how I was representing this community that, you know, I'm really an outsider.
It took a few months for Hans to produce a CD. And once he did, he asked his good friend, a teacher in the Maasai community, what the money from the CD sales could be used for.
There are a lot of people who didn't have the opportunity to go to school and wanted to. A lot of women are married off early on and they don't get a chance to go to school. And then a lot of men are pulled out to start looking after cattle or become warriors. They become warriors in their teenage years. So the first goal was just to actually hire a teacher and pay them to teach people how to read and write.
So Hans held a CD release party in his hometown of Duluth, Minnesota.
It was packed. I mean, it kind of blew me away. There I am. I hadn't even arranged for somebody to sell CDs. I had thought this this thing so poorly, other than just promoting the heck out of it. I forgot about the actual event. This is just the story of me in Kenya is just kind of stumbling around and kind of figuring out and making mistakes and making an idiot out of myself, but learning from it or trying to learn from it.
They raised enough money to start an adult literacy program at a community church. And Hans's friend, the teacher, would oversee it.
And then he would send me reports about how things were going. And eventually I did meet the students, and you know, they were very excited to know how to read. And one of our women, she was able to join the school board of her children's school because now she can read and she can look at the government papers and read what they're saying and make decisions. She felt like she had some power. And another woman started a business because she knows she was learning how to add and divide and multiply and all this stuff. So she was excited.
The adult literacy program had been running for over a year, and people that knew what Hans was doing wanted to help.
I have a friend who is a musician, and he said, you know, I'd like to help you out with your projects, but what do you need? And I said, you know, I have ideas, but let me ask them. They said that they, when I say they, the small group of men, I should note that it was males, told me that they would like to build a school.
Is there a reason that you mentioned that men made that decision for the school?
Absolutely. I just say the men because, you know, you looking back, I assumed that they were speaking for the whole community, and maybe they were, but I think it was better. The next projects I've done, we definitely talk to more wider variety of men, women, and young women, young men, older men, and older women.
Hans's musician friend performed some shows and helped to raise enough money for a school building. At this point, Hans was in college, so
I left my good friend in charge of that project.
The teacher.
And the school started being built, and I watched the progress in pictures, and it was going great. But then the communication started to falter a bit. There were no hard feelings or anything. I just stopped hearing or getting certain answers to certain questions I had. I kept requesting receipts, and they never came. You know, and I understand it was difficult because my friends were living in a place that was far from any sort of electricity they could afford.
So Hans traveled to Kenya to see what was going on.
At that point, it had no roof or windows, but it had the foundation was there, the structure there. They'd obviously done a lot of work, and it looked good.
The first thing you really see that, okay, wow, this is coming out of something that started with a kid with a backpack and a recorder.
I love that. Did you ever imagine?
I guess, you know, I really went over the first trip. I went over just to record music. I didn't even think about doing any project or even ever returning. And then when I went there, I started learning about the needs and the wants and the community. I fell in love with the Maasai culture and the Maasai people. And I didn't really envision much. Things kind of fell into my lap, to be quite honest.
When he was visiting the school, Hans asked his teacher friend to be better about communicating. And together they made a list of the work that was remaining. There was the roof, the windows.
And plastering the inside and making it smooth and painting and a chalkboard and desks and chairs. And I was told the amounts that needed and I sent them over. And I didn't get any pictures as I requested. That probably would have been a good time for me to have taken a step back. But I just really wanted to believe in this person. You put your faith in somebody that you really believe in, and you know, you hope it works out. And again, they put faith in me that I'm going to keep sending the funds. Think about it from their perspective too, you know.
Meanwhile, news of this new school building continued to spread, and more donations came in. This meant that there were more donors with a vested interest in the project, and it also meant more pressure on Hans. Hans was frustrated that he didn't hear anything. So on the next break he had from college, he went over to Kenya again to try and see the school. But when he got to Kenya, the country was in chaos. There was a recent presidential election and people weren't happy with the results. There was violence throughout the country. And unfortunately, Hans wasn't able to get to the village and he wasn't able to see the school.
And I came back home and I had, you know, a student, had no money. It was really frustrating, very frustrating not to be able to see the school. And the emails and it started coming, and you know.
The emails did come, but they were from a pastor in the community. The pastor said, "Your good friend, the teacher, he's stealing your money." At this point, Hans had started a nonprofit, and he and his board talked about helping to run the school.
We were just a bunch of college kids who had no time on our hands, but a lot of desire and dreams. I tried to kind of help run it, but you know, it just didn't work out. The communication was really difficult.
Hans never confronted his teacher friend. He told me that he just let it be.
It's tough to leave something that you work on so hard and believe in to just let it go.
Hans made one more trip to deliver desks and chairs. Even though he wasn't able to help run the school, he wanted to make sure that it had everything it needed for students to learn. This story might seem like it's about trusting more than one person and performing better accounting. And to an extent it is. But it's the conflict that Hans faced that forced him to reflect. He thought about his intentions, his assumptions, and how best to help. He learned that when coming from a place of privilege, sometimes you can get wrapped up in trying to fix something without really understanding the culture and the complexities.
I think anybody who wants to do a project, you know, try it and learn from it, but really know what you're getting into or try to. Basically, you know, just because somebody is, for example, poorer than you, I know, but we consider that a big thing. How much money do people make? I really tell people, don't assume that what you think is good for them or what you've seen other people doing for them is necessarily good for them. There are things that seem so straightforward and so obvious and common sense, quote unquote, to us, that really when you look at the nature of the community and the people, your culture doesn't just naturally fit.
He learned that helping is best when you're present and committed.
You know, people ask me, how can I get involved? You know, I really want to help somebody, but I don't know what to do. And I say, you know, to be quite honest, if I had to do it all over again, I probably would have gotten involved in something in my own community. I was broke when I was a kid, and there were people around me who volunteered in my community, artists and other people who took me and kind of helped show me other things and just say, you know what, you're not just a broke kid, you can do other things in your life and go to college. I had one person really encouraged me to go to college. I probably wouldn't have if it wasn't for her. I say get involved in your own community, because it's like a long distance relationship that you never are going to get together unless you really want to move to Kenya or wherever. You know, I go back now because I'm invested in, I really invest a lot of my life and into this area, and I know I have great friends there and family now. I'm invested there.
For the school project, Hans had started with money, asking one person and then a small group of people how they would spend it. He learned instead to start with questions, asking the whole community what's important to them and what could be better. Because of his work with the Maasai, Hans met his wife, a member of one of the villages. Together, they would work on the next project.
She encouraged us to go do this water project this year. I had not done anything for several years. I really burnt out. She said, you know, let's do this water project. This community has been asking for us to, you know, to do something. They get terrible droughts, and I've known about it for a while. It's been something that has been on my mind a lot, but I didn't know what to do. And things just kind of fell into place, and my wife was really encouraging and saying, you know what, let's do this. Just because you had some hardship doesn't mean that you need to stop. You need some breathing time, but you know what, I know who you are, and you can do this. We can do it together. So, you know, she helped me kind of come up, and we fundraised, and this summer we built this water tank, and it felt amazing to do something that really, really was a community project. And I mean it in every sense. We did interviews beforehand with everybody, and we really learned what they wanted before we got into this. The result was great, because once the tank was built and the water was flowing out of it, seeing the people collecting the water and how much it meant to them, and how just everybody was praising it.
Today our focus is knowing how to help, and our next story discusses the importance of feedback. Only a short distance from the Maasai villages are huge cities like Nairobi and Mombasa. In and around these cities are slums, a sea of makeshift shelters where millions of people live, like a man named Alex. Alex grew up in Kawangware, a slum in Nairobi with around 800,000 people, 65% being kids and youth. He was an AIDS orphan and spent most of his childhood in and out of homes. When he was 17, Alex decided that he would take care of himself. So he collected garbage and spent a lot of time living on the streets. But he didn't have any other options. There were no jobs. For youth in Kenya, Alex's story isn't unique. 70% of people between the ages of 18 and 35 are unemployed. That's nearly 10 million people. Without other options, some people steal, join terror organizations, or sell their bodies just to survive. Earlier this year, I spoke with Tanya Layden, the co-founder of an organization called Livelihoods. Her goal is to give people like Alex an opportunity to change their future. Here's Tanya and the story of how Livelihoods is helping youth and women in Kenya.
Initially, the idea was to help youth start their own businesses and give them entrepreneurship training and loans, which I think is a pretty common model.
So they tested out this idea. They recruited 7 youth to participate in a pilot program to start their own businesses. Alex was one of the recruits. But after about 2 weeks into the program, they had some concerns. They said,
you know, we don't want loans. We don't want to start our own businesses. We really just want jobs. We just want to get some experience. And then maybe we'll start our own businesses, or maybe, you know, we won't. Maybe we'll go back to school. Maybe, you know, get jobs somewhere else. But really, if you want to help us, you'll help us get jobs. I think very fortunately, you know, we got that feedback and actually listened to that feedback and said, okay, you know, I understand what you don't want to do. Now help us figure out what it is that you do want to do.
So they went out and surveyed about 300 young people from their community, and they discovered a common skill among everyone. They had all sold something.
From fruit and vegetables to phone credit, to drugs, to shoes and clothes. Everyone had had some kind of experience with sales. We got to understand that sales was something, you know, it was a basic skill set that we could build on. And also that if we were able to build on their sales skills, that those would be useful for them for the rest of their lives.
So they knew they would sell something, but now they had to figure out what to sell. At this time, Tanya's co-founder was going to incubators, accelerators, conferences, and meeting other social entrepreneurs. She met a lot of people that designed products to improve lives of low-income families, like solar lamps and clean-burning cook stoves, but they didn't have a way to reach the market that they wanted to.
And that's kind of where I came in, where it was just this idea that, okay, we have these product companies on one side, and we have unemployed youth on the other side, and we have kind of untapped market in urban slum communities. Can we kind of solve several problems at the same time?
So they ran another pilot with the same group of people. And this time they were selling products. It went really well. People from their community wanted to buy the cook stoves and the solar lamps, and they wanted more. So they hired more sales agents. And here's how the sales model works. Livelihoods offers free sales training to youth and women. And after they take the training, it's their choice if they want to actually go out and sell. Those that do, they'll pick out a product, let's say a cook stove, and then they'll try and sell it. They take that product out on consignment, so it's kind of like a micro loan. And if they sell it, they come back to the branch and they bring back a portion of the money. If they don't end up selling that product, they can try again the next day, or they can return it and take out something else to try and sell. With only earning a few dollars a day, their target market is very picky about what products they want to buy and where they want to spend their money.
So that's why it's very important to, you know, have a salesperson who's explaining the benefits of these products and the cost savings that come with these products. Yeah, it really is people from these communities who are selling to, you know, their network.
And as I was talking to Tanya, I realized how much she relies on her team.
It was just me kind of grinding away. It would be very difficult, but, you know, having a really solid team that I get to work with and that I know really well has definitely made that much more bearable.
How do you work together as a team? Like, what do you do as a leader to ensure that there's a good team dynamic?
Yeah, just a lot of dialogue. And I don't know if this was kind of has been ingrained in the organization since that, you know, really important piece of feedback about not wanting loans and to start their own businesses. But we meet with our sales agents every morning and they give us feedback. We give them feedback, all very consultative. You know, decisions aren't really made without talking to the sales agents first or talking to the branch managers first or to the trainers first. If it concerns them, it's just a big part of, you know, how we do things is consulting the people who decisions will affect.
And this consultative approach helped the team work through major challenges. One was a cook stove shortage.
Every year since 2011, with the exception of this year, we've had 3 to 6 month supply gaps of the cook stoves. Given that it's our best-selling product, it has a really huge impact on sales, on morale, on momentum.
Cook stoves can account for 90% of their sales sometimes, so not having them available causes a big problem. So Tanya had an idea to find something that they could sell. She took a few members of her team to a local department store, similar to a Walmart.
And just said, pick some products, tell us what you think you can sell. And they're like, no, we can't, we're going to get arrested. And I was like, nothing's going to happen, just take the products you want to sell and put them in a basket. At the end, we'll see what's in everyone's baskets. And they were like, no, if you put the products in a basket, then you have to buy them. We don't have any money to buy them. But they had never been inside of one of these stores, even though it could be like 100 feet away from the slums or from an area that they might otherwise frequent. But they really wouldn't go inside just because it's not for them. You know, the target demographic for those stores are really middle, upper middle class. What that showed me was that there's a big psychological barrier for any of our target population going into these stores. And there's plenty of products in there that would be of interest to them that are sometimes cheaper than what they can find in the slums, because what you find in the slums are often secondhand or very low quality with no warranty.
The team selected some products that they thought their community could use.
Things like blenders and irons and microwaves.
Because the sales agents know what the community needs. And Tanya relies on their feedback. They were able to sell during a time that they otherwise wouldn't.
Kind of having the challenge of a supply gap also led us to a product category that has been responsible for anywhere from, 20-50% of our sales sometimes.
Another test for Tanya came with a very tempting offer.
Early on, so sometime probably in 2012, we got an offer from a lottery company for our sales agents to sell lottery tickets. So, they had donated some computers and they were, helping us in other ways. And they were just really interested in having our sales agents go out and sell. From that, we could create a lot of jobs. We could also actually probably have made enough money to not have to fundraise that year or maybe any more.
The stakes were high. This meant no more fundraising, and they could create more jobs. Tanya and her team thought about it. They thought, what was best for the community? What was best for the employees?
We weren't going to create jobs that these youth could be proud of or that were really challenging for them, or that would really be bridging the gap between their community and access to products that would really be beneficial for them. So we turned that down. It meant that we, had to fundraise, have had to fundraise a lot. But it also helped kind of define for us, or forced us to define what was important.
For Tanya, feedback is something that should be planned for.
I'd say the best way, or the way that I think is most effective for actually getting and using that feedback, is having it be kind of a regular part of, I don't want to say the culture, but your processes. Like when it's part of the culture, it's just maybe it's something you do, but it's not on your schedule necessarily. Otherwise it's something that you want to do, but you might not get to. But I think when people know that they have that time regularly, it's conducive to more sharing.
This environment of sharing and feedback has helped Livelihoods to employ hundreds of youth across Kenya. When Livelihoods started, Tanya and her co-founder could have decided to push forward with the microloans so youth could start small businesses. But instead, they decided to gather feedback and listen to that feedback. And because they did, people like Alex have jobs, and jobs that they can be proud of. Alex is still with Livelihoods today, and now he helps to employ more youth as the training and recruitment manager. Thanks for listening to the show. If you want to learn more about Hans or Tanya, visit changemakerpodcast.com. Music is by The Maasai People of East Africa and Hans Johnson. Remote, Philip Weigel, Kevin McLeod, Jazar, Lee Rosevere, Little Grass Men, and Josh Woodward. I'm Jackie Biederman. And you've been listening to stories from people making a difference on Changemaker. If you like what you've been hearing, please share the podcast with your friends. It would be awesome if these stories and their impact could spread. And if you want to know the latest on upcoming shows and interesting things that I'm finding along the way, sign up for my newsletter. Just go to changemakerpodcast.com. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the second pilot episode from the archives. If you have been liking Changemaker and you have 1 minute, I could really use your help. Are you in? Awesome. So just head over to iTunes and take a minute to leave a great review. It really does help to spread these stories to more people. And if you don't have iTunes, please tell one friend about the show. And thank you so much for your support.